Hey, and welcome back to the A24 podcast. We've been waiting for the perfect moment to get Ari Aster and Robert Eggers together for a conversation, and we finally found that moment last month, the morning after Rob saw the final cut of Midsommar. For anyone already listening, these two need no further introduction. Keep your eye out for an extended cut of this episode dropping next week, for serious Bergman fans only. Here's Ari and Rob.
Okay, we're doing it.
Okay.
This is Robert Eggers.
This is Ari Aster.
And we're doing the A24 podcast, which is cool. We're doing it together.
Yeah, which feels appropriate given that we're both friends.
Totally.
Who seem to like each other's work.
And the same stuff.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, we have a goal, which is we're trying to orient this discussion around the work of Ingmar Bergman. We probably won't succeed, but we're going to give it a shot.
Yeah, I thought you were joking when you first suggested it, but I'm excited to dive in. I know that we're both devotees. You can probably see it in our work. Feels appropriate.
Yeah.
So we met a couple years ago. I was doing, it wasn't really a friends and family screening of Hereditary. I think there were friends and family of A24, but I didn't know anybody there.
Yeah, A24 asked me to go to a screening of something that I didn't know anything about, aside from that it was a horror movie.
I think it was the first of those that we had done, and the room, you know, like, did not seem to love it. And I remember going up in front of the, everyone who had just seen the film, like, very, like, stern faces that were, like, ready to cut me down to size. And you and your wife, Allie, were sitting, like, near the front, and you gave me, like, two thumbs up. And you had a very warm smile on your face. And it, like, I held on to that as my lifeline as people in the room proceeded to explain to me that, you know, I was a bastard and I made a worthless movie.
Yeah, well, you did not. I mean, I was totally blown away, especially because I had no expectations, and it was fantastic. And it was really, I mean, it was so smart and truly inspiring to me, and I was really some of the craft of the camera work I didn't even perceive because I was so impressed with the breadcrumbs that you were laying with the screenplay. And anyway, it was a real joy, and I had the great pleasure of seeing a finished version of Midsommar last night, and it was great. I also saw, like, an earlier version, and I don't know what you cut, but I felt like the film was tighter and had way more shit in it.
Yeah, you know that when you, like, finish something, when the music's there and the color, it does just feel so much more substantial.
For sure. It's really excellent. And so now to try to shoehorn...
Hold that. I just need to, like, I cannot, like, receive a compliment without, like, reciprocating when I have one to give, because I have not seen the finished version of The Lighthouse, but I did see a cut that was nearly finished, and I have the feeling that you would never show a cut to anybody that isn't nearly finished. I love The Lighthouse, and I'm so excited to see what it is now that it's done. But what I saw felt finished.
Well, thank you.
It is, like, it's so beautiful, so beautifully done, and really funny. I know I've said this before, and you've had kind of an inscrutable expression, so I don't know if this feels right to you, but it really made me think of Harold Pinter, who I love, and I mean, I can't really think of any other work that feels like Harold Pinter besides... You know, I mean, like, what else plays, like, The Servant or, you know, No Man's Land or, like, you know, The Homecoming? And this felt to me a total, like, spiritual sibling. And even though it reminds me of Harold Pinter, it reminds me of nothing else, including Harold Pinter. It just feels, like, totally unique.
Thank you. Anyway, thank you. That's really
Harold
nice.
Harold Pinter by way of...
No. That's way too kind.
By way of Bellatar, I would say, but... Pretty incredible.
Well, thank you. That's like, that's far too kind. All right, I'm on this Bergman mission. Damn it.
Okay.
So everyone has close-ups. Like, Bergman doesn't own close-ups, but there's something less in some of the center-framed things in the latter portion of Midsommar, but the earliest stuff with Danny gave a sort of Bergman-y vibe to me. And I know that just because the movie takes place in Sweden, I feel like people talk about Bergman in relation to Midsommar in a way that maybe is like inappropriate. Tarkovsky, Sacrifice, people would always say that it's Bergman-esque, which would really piss him off because he said this has nothing to do with Bergman films.
Except for Sven Nykvist shooting
it. It's like if you have Bergman's entire crew designing and shooting the film.
Josephson.
Is in the film. Yeah. It's going to feel a little Bergman-y, right?
Yeah. I mean, we've talked a lot about Bergman before. He's a hero of mine. I love his films. I was thinking a lot more about his work when I was making Hereditary, particularly Cries and Whispers, and I showed the crew Autumn Sonata because of the mother-daughter parallels. Nobody shoots close-ups like him. I definitely, when we were making Hereditary again, I made my cinematographer, Pavel Pogorzelski, who's also one of my best friends, I made him watch Persona, just because I think those are like the most beautiful close-ups I've ever seen in a film. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there is this, I'm not sure if it's like a recent trend, but I'm seeing filmmakers like really clearly chasing the Bergman close-up. Even if you look at like P.T. Anderson, who loved to talk early in his career about how he was like kind of chasing the Jonathan Demme close-up, and the way those look, especially starting with The Master, that he's moving kind of like away from Demme and Scorsese and Altman towards especially Bergman in the way he frames close-ups and obviously Kubrick too. But there is this like the box quality, right? Where you give just enough headroom and you typically like bring the camera like 2 or 3 inches below the nose.
And shooting in like 2:1 is a nice compromise for getting scope and still getting really healthy close-ups where you're not like chopping people's like head pieces of their heads off. So it's nice to see.
I love 2:1. I know that Pavel and I chose 2:1 for Hereditary because it was like Douglas Sirk's favorite aspect ratio his chosen aspect ratio. And we were making this domestic movie set in a house. And
it feels right.
It's like, how do you get the height, the width, but also like some of the height, but when you're indoors, like that can box you in. And then I was kind of surprised that we landed on that for Midsommar because we said like, let's try something else. And then
on paper, 2:1 for Midsommar seems like perfect. Like I could see something box like 1:66 even for Hereditary.
Well, you went with Academy, right?
We went with 1:66 for The Witch. We didn't want to go so boxy as Academy, but we did want more height for trees, and we did want something boxier for the interiors. And of course, so that film we shot on Alexa, and because for anamorphic, because the sensor is 4:3 and we were using these like old lenses, we were actually got more of the like lens characteristic. That was really cool, and something that then for The Lighthouse, shooting on 35mm in an even stupider aspect ratio, we were able to take advantage of. I think like the A24 gods are not smiling at us for being maybe like too obscure.
I feel like we could get more obscure.
Oh, we could, but like, you know. What about everyone's least favorite topic? Certainly mine. Genre. Our films and genre. I think Hereditary is a horror movie. Like, for people who feel like it's not, like, I get why.
Yeah, yeah. I actually don't get why. It is like absolutely unabashedly a horror film. Like, that was the goal. And I feel like I was like misquoted like crazy on, I mean, I'd rather like just never speak ever and just like release the movie.
Sure.
But you have to do the press. And
yeah.
I, it's just a minefield because you just say something kind of flippantly and then it becomes like your statement on the film. But no,
like the Wizard of Oz for perverts.
Yeah, which I was like drunk and, you know, I mean, I'm fine with it, but I wouldn't want it to be, you know, like my
on the cover of the Blu-ray.
I hereby designate Midsommar right. The Wizard of Oz for perverts. That's that was not my intention, but like it was the first thing I said, and like now it's, you know, the last word. But I think I said something about like, you know, it's a family tragedy that like becomes like a nightmare, and the fact that I like wasn't actually using the word horror, it somehow the omission became like a statement. But it's a horror movie, of course. Like that's what I wanted to do. There're people like crawling on walls, you know.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And then, you know, Midsommar is maybe something else.
I don't know. I mean, it's horror adjacent. I feel like an asshole even saying the word adjacent. I see it as a fairy tale more than anything, especially because of just like her trajectory, like her arc. If anything, I think like the trick of the movie, or like what I kind of got excited about doing, was like for everybody else, like for every other visitor in that film, including her boyfriend, like it's a folk horror movie without any like shame or without any like pretensions to something else. It's a folk horror movie. But for her, this perverse wish fulfillment fantasy that like is just ultimately a fairy tale where like this community could be seen as a, you know, I want them to be read, at least on first viewing, before you kind of get a sense of what this thing really is. Like, that they're like this real place with like a real history and like rich traditions. But, you know, I can't watch the film anymore without seeing them like as strictly manifestations of Danny's like will.
And it's cool, this version, the finished version, you know, or maybe it's also just watching it again, because as we all know, watching films multiple times is important to really understanding them. It felt so much more from Danny's perspective, partially in some of the like visual effects treatment to things, but even just in the editing choices. That at least that's how I experienced it the second time. And everything you're saying, like everything you just said, really resonated with my experience of watching it the second time last night.
Nice, that's great.
So it was pretty sick. By the way, did you ever watch any of those like 70s English TV folk horror like M.R. James things that I sent you?
Oh my god, I didn't.
No, it's okay.
Oh fuck. No, I was really excited about it, but you sent it to me exactly at the time where like
where you were done watching
shit. I was
shit.
Neglecting everything that anybody sent me, and
I understand.
And I like, you know, just burned like every bridge in my life.
That's fine. That's
except
fine.
For with the people who know what it's like to make a movie and like, you know, just kind of
yeah, you're going to be MIA disappear. And it's fine. Yeah.
Before we move on, I want to know like, you know, what genre you'd like place The Witch in, but I'm really interested to know like how you might categorize The Lighthouse.
Yeah, I would, again, I completely understand why people don't see The Witch as a horror movie. That it was certainly my attempt to make a horror movie. So I saw it as that, even though certainly like the family drama is more important. I mean, like you see a witch flying on a broomstick. I mean, maybe that's not scary, but like that's certainly
it's awesome.
You
it's
know,
really
a horror trope or whatever it should be, even if it wasn't successfully so. But for my money, that was horror. And the Lighthouse, if I've had to like designate a genre, it would be the literary genre of a weird tale like M.R. James, Blackwood, Lovecraft. But it is something else even than that. But that would sort of be...
You even have the octopus.
Right, exactly.
For Lovecraft.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it certainly was just something, an idea that I had that got out of control, and my brother and I wrote it and had fun. But I think it's also funny how the different ways in which auteurs of a certain caliber like will or won't talk about genre or say their film is genre or like laughs off the idea of genre being important. And even more interestingly is people who are sort of sophisticated filmmakers feel that like horror genre, whatever that means to them, is like not something that one could consider art, that can like really talk about what it means to be a human being, but is rather just some sort of cheap commercial thing. But obviously these horror stories, things like Hereditary, that actually do probe the darker side of humanity in like a serious way, like that's incredibly important.
Yeah.
And should be respected, man.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, there was at least like a 5-year period in my adolescence where like horror movies were like the only thing. I had this like this three ring binder that I kept adding badly photocopied like black and white, because that's all I had, because we had a black and white printer, images from the internet from horror movies. So it was just like, I like drew a lot. And so I guess like that was the point. It was a weird, I guess I have like a collector's thing where I just never actually went through this thing, but I just kept adding to it. So it was awesome. Like this compulsive.
Do you still have it?
Hobby. I'm sure it's somewhere. I mean, it would take, I mean, it's going to be in some box, right, like right. somewhere in my family's home.
I'd be curious to see how much of your primal narrative began there. like everyone makes the same movie or writes the same book or paints the same painting over and over and over again.
I think what it was too is that there were films that really, really affected me and scared me. I was really impressionable as a kid. And there were a few films that I just like, I saw them too young, didn't know how to process them. Like I was clearly like, I mean, I'm sure I made associations like subconsciously that then, you know, enhanced everything. Like Carrie really destroyed me. I wasn't able to watch it again until like my 20s. And then I realized like, it's like a really sad comedy, but,
right.
but it's,
no,
it's,
but as for a kid, I mean, it's,
it really like, I could not get the image of Piper Laurie like chasing Sissy Spacek around this like candlelit house out of my head. She's got this like horrible smile holding a knife, and like that just like has like come back to me in so many ways. Just like still I'll have like a nightmare about that.
And that sort of like weird tone of that film that's like unrealistic, almost kind of unprofessional, yeah.
And and sentimental with the Pino Donaggio score.
For a kid, I can see that being like very disturbing, especially because it's like it's so dissonant with like the sort of Disney Spielberg like thing that is supposed to be normal movie viewing. You know,
absolutely, and it is that artifice and that like there's like a romance to it that's really upsetting. And then I talked about this so much on the press tour for Hereditary that I like, you know, kind of, I don't want to talk about it again, but if we're talking about things that affected us, like Cook the Thief, his wife and her lover,
sure.
saw that too young, that like really bothered me in like a deep, deep way. And I remember there was a kid's cartoon 30 minutes long called The Snowman. But like,
I don't know what that is.
I think it's like a kid, like a girl or a little boy get on a snowman's like back and like fly through the world. I can't remember even what the story was, but I just remember that it like bugged me.
Wow.
So I know that there's something about like the maudlin when combined with something, I don't know, like the maudlin and the grotesque when they kind of meet. As a kid, I like couldn't process that.
Yeah.
And there's also just like a mean-spiritedness to certain films that like really bugged me as a kid, and then I kind of became obsessed with that tradition. Like I saw Blue Velvet and like Clockwork Orange when I was just very young and I hated them. Mm-hmm. But then I like became obsessed and I couldn't stop talking about it. And then they obviously became like, you know, some of my favorite films. Blue Velvet, there's nothing original about like loving Blue Velvet, but it is just the greatest thing yeah. ever, like ever. I don't know if you had this experience, but certainly like the things I hated when I first encountered them because they felt kind of evil, those are the things that kind of I kept returning to, and they became obsessions and fascinations. And then, I mean, I don't know what I do in my own work because I'm like too close to it. My nose is like certainly like right up against this movie. I have no objectivity, but I imagine that there's, you know, that I can see myself like kind of still wrestling with what it is that fascinates me about narratives like that. What about you? I mean, like just, you know, like what got to you as a kid? Like what were your early influences? Like what were the films that you like first? Like I certainly wrote a lot of scripts like as a teenager that like were extremely derivative of like one or two things.
Sure,
that I just, like,
right.
Wanted, like wished that I had made. Like I wonder if that's other people's experience of like when you first start making things. Like
I mean, I think we're all derivative in the beginning. And I remember seeing some Picasso exhibit in my 20s, being really happy to see that after his sort of academic, what we would call photorealistic period, that then he was just painting like any other impressionist before he became, I mean, but better.
Yeah.
but it was just like what everyone else is doing. And then he became himself. I actually, even The Witch to me feels like derivative. Like I feel like it wears its influences on its sleeve much more than The Lighthouse. Like I think you can identify influences in The Lighthouse for sure. But I feel like collectively it sort of, I think I'm starting to become myself a little more, which hopefully I'll continue to do. But yeah, I mean, whatever, from Mary Poppins to like Conan the Barbarian, like in Ridley Scott's Legend, I don't know, and Star Wars and Indiana Jones and all that crap. I think the first movie that wasn't a movie that would be easy to access that was very influential, which I've also talked about plenty, is Nosferatu.
Yeah.
I saw an image of Max Schreck in a book about vampires in the elementary school library. And at that time, especially in like rural New Hampshire, like it was, you couldn't just, you know, whatever. So we had to like go to the video store 45 minutes away and order it and then wait for it to come in the mail and whatever. And I wore that VHS out. But it's funny because as a kid, I could watch shit that I think is boring today, just being intrigued by what are adults up to. I do have a fondness for Merchant Ivory films, but I definitely do. Yeah, but like the bad, like the boring ones, like even as a kid, like if my parents would be watching that shit, I'd be like, oh man, the Bostonians. Like yeah. I had no idea what was going on, but you would just, but it was just like interesting to watch grown up people doing weird things.
What about, I want to ask you, what is it that kind of like first drew you to like esoterica? Because clearly, like you have this real fascination with bygone eras, and like, I mean, you're clearly like a person who loves creating worlds, but you also really love like recreating worlds.
Yeah, for some reason, I was really always into costumes, and I used to wear costumes to school. I used to ask for costumes for Christmas presents. I don't know like where that comes from, but that was something that was always really interesting to me. And so then books about fashion history, like I know that my grandmother who died did some costume design for community theater and like university ballet, so she had some like books when I was like super little, like 4 and stuff, that were like lushly illustrated, that I still have like one of them that I like drew all over. Like it'd be like someone's like, you know, just like a bust of somebody, and I would like drew with markers their legs, like really shitty, like, you know, what is like 6'4" or whatever. And then my grandfather collected antiques and he knew a lot about them, and so that became a germ of something. And then when we would go on like family trips to like Colonial Williamsburg and Plymouth Plantation, things that a lot of people thought maybe were boring, I fucking loved it. Yeah. You know, I was like, yeah, like I want to be a blacksmith. This is great. And I love talking to the living history nerds. Like I thought it was the coolest thing. And then there was another, this is like a sort of gross story, but my dad taught at the University of New Hampshire, and there was a art show by this Latvian immigrant, Hyman Bloom. And he was like a New England painter who had this retrospective that was like really amazing. And he had all these like hellish imagery of like demons and astral planes and stuff, like these a huge scale. My dad met him, and my parents got along with he and his wife, and he would come over a lot. And I was just enamored of this artist, because at the time I wanted to be a visual artist. And he was like, a very wizardly person in my eye, but he was very gentle, and I would talk with him about comic books and Star Wars and stuff, and he was like down to hear it. But he gave me 2 books of one that was like only Durer and one that was like Martin Schongauer and other Northern Renaissance people, and he was like, if you can draw this, you can draw anything. And I kind of threw my comic books away, and I kind of abandoned being interested in pop culture things mostly at that point. Then I would still kind of like occasionally, you know, go, I was like obligatorily see the like Christopher Nolan Batman movies like into my early 20s, and eventually, I mean, they're great for what they're, you know, and Nolan's great and whatever, but you know, I had the taste of a fucking dilettante since I was a little kid. I don't know what to say. It's kind of, it's like saying all that makes me want to vomit, but it is the case.
Yeah. I've been to your apartment. I don't think it's where you're living now, mm-mm, but I saw your little like punishment room where you just like filled with books. like I definitely noticed a lot of like first editions in there, and it definitely felt like a room that belonged to somebody who, like, you know, has spent his life going into like used bookstores looking for out of print books, which I recognize because that, you know, I'm not that far away from being that person myself.
Well, that's why we get along, buddy. So Bergman liked to work with the same crew, and he liked to work with the same like troupe of actors. And I think most filmmakers wish that they had that core group. Working on your second film, how much were you able to bring on crew from Hereditary? How much did you want to? Talk about that.
So Pavel, my DP, and I have been working together since grad school, since AFI, and he is just one of my best friends, and we have this great shorthand, and we just like share the same taste and see things in a very like in the same way, and we argue very little. I would say like when there is a misunderstanding, like we take it like very badly, like on set if it turns out that we thought we understood each other, but like we had different ideas, like we get like upset and like need a minute. He and I have this total shorthand, and you know he's I love the guy, and I'm very grateful for that relationship in my life, not just professionally, but he's also just like, you know, a beautiful person. And then, you know, I had a really incredible time on Hereditary with my production designer and costume designer. And that was Grace Yuen and Olga Mill.
I've worked with Olga Mill, by the way, on like short films when I was like in the dregs of the New York indie garbage pail.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
Yeah, she's amazing.
I loved it. And, you know, the only reason that I didn't work with them on Midsommar, for instance, is because Midsommar was a project that I got started, I guess, almost 5 years ago. And we had a Swedish production designer named Henrik Svensson, who was on from the beginning. He did an incredible job. And he and I kind of had this dialogue going for, you know, 4 years. And he was building this, like, really, I mean, giant lookbook, you know, and he'd send it to me. And it was filled with references. And I would then, like, remove certain references that weren't working for me. And then I'd add my own. And then that would provoke him to add more. And then he'd send that to me. And then I'd add more and take out some. I mean, this thing, like, is, like, 300 pages. And that was really great because once we dove into pre-production, we had no time. Like, we had to build this entire village in just over 2 months. It was really big, and we could have only done it in Hungary. So he did an amazing job. I think he almost lost his mind just from, you know, the pressure of it. And so did I, by the way. I mean, like, the water was always, like, just up to my nose on this film. There were times on set that I had to just, like, walk to a corner and, like, cry, which I probably, you know, like, shouldn't admit. But like, there were crew people who were probably either, like, caught it and saw that, like, the director was crying in the corner, or that maybe looked like I was, like, laughing maniacally. Like, either way, it's probably, like, a troubling sight. So that was a really great collaboration. I'm really proud of his work. And then we worked with a Hungarian costume designer, again, because we needed somebody local, named Andrea Fleisch, who is really, or Andrea Flesch? I'm used to calling her Andrea, but really, really brilliant woman, like so good at what she does. And so she was incredible. And, you know, we did as much as we could with the time and the budget. Like we definitely had ideas for the costumes that, like, you know, kind of just like
came to fruition. Like, was it all Scandinavian, or was there some Slavic influence in the clothing of the villagers?
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely Slavic influence.
Yeah, and I also thought I like saw like an embroidered Elizabethan coif.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a stew. Like
I think it's a very successful like melange. Like it comes together as something that looks uniform and its own thing. But I thought I saw these.
Oh no, you definitely did. There are things that we pulled from, you know, Russia, from certainly from Scandinavia, and Andrea would be able to like expound much further. But you know, it was very important to us that like every costume had different runes incorporated because like these costumes like belong to these people,
right,
and like they have adopted runes. runes that like represent them. And then beyond that, there was a Swedish consultant on the film, Martin Carlqvist, who I, you know, is just like the best guy ever. And he sort of invented this language called the affect language.
That's the aspiration stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's like the emotional sheet music, right? Which is a combination of like the runic alphabet and then like all of these emotional hieroglyphs that, you know, are kind of made up, but also drawn from several sources. I mean, even every pair of shoes has like its own thing going on.
Yeah.
We went as far as we could in the time we had, like, to prepare. And
I think it's very successful, particularly the clothing, for me. Like, you know, the clothing particularly, like, really belonged.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. I'm really proud of her work. And she's just, like, such a sweet person. And her crew was, like, so great.
Yeah.
I guess that's my kind of long-winded, meandering answer as to, like, you know, who I've worked with on these last two films in those departments. I mean, in post-production, I've worked with Luke Johnson for both films.
Yeah.
He's such a nice guy. Yeah. So smart. He was the assistant editor on Hereditary, and I was working with Jen Lame, who's also just one of my favorite people and, you know, at this point, one of my best friends. And she's actually now working on Christopher Nolan's new film, so she's she's moving fast. But Luke was such a big part of editing Hereditary that we just gave him an editor credit.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I would have done Midsommar with both him and Jen again, but Jen was busy.
Yeah.
And so I just pulled on Luke, and he's somebody that I will keep working with as well. Like, he's definitely on the team at this point.
Awesome.
How about you?
I had the great fortune to be able to work with virtually all my keys from The Witch on The Lighthouse. The thing is, I developed two larger studio movies that like didn't happen. And so when The Lighthouse became an option and we were shooting in Canada again, it was very easy to get the gang back. And we also had an accelerated prep period, and we never could have built that world without working with Craig Lathrop and Linda Muir again, because we have the right language and the right working relationship already, and it's spectacular work. Jaron Blaschke, the DP, we worked together on all of my short films that aren't embarrassing, and I worked with him as a production designer on other directors' things, and yeah, that shorthand and yada yada. But he's incredible. He's an artist. I don't use that word to describe very many people. And also, I mean, and it's a real collaboration. I mean, my films are, if and when they are praised for like the cinematic language, it would not be that way without Jaron. I'm not, I think you are like this, but I'm not like Scorsese sort of dictating like, this is every shot, please carry it out. Like we are working on trying to find the most like essential, simplest language for each scene. And Louise Ford, the Lighthouse editor, I've known her for basically as long as Jaron, and we have the same tight knit relationship. And I must say that the edit and the color correct were the only parts of making The Lighthouse that weren't fucking miserable and incredibly difficult. And like,
same for me, same here.
Like everything was so hard about The Lighthouse, but the edit was a joy. Not that Lou and I didn't ever work cut out for us, but it was like quite pleasant.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And before we move on from that, I also want to mention Lars Knudsen, my producer, who I met on Hereditary, that was definitely, you know, like I could not have made it through this film without him. And he and I just started a production company. And I really love the guy. He's like, he's just a total enabler.
Lars is incredible. I worked with him on The Witch. I'm going to be working with him in the future. I mean, also, I mean, if we're like going in this direction, which we should be, RT Features and New Regency and A24 gave me like incredible freedom.
Yeah.
I can't believe I made that movie. It's kind of nuts. So thanks, guys.
Yeah. No, I mean, it feels a little sycophantic talking about A24 on the A24 podcast,
yeah.
but they are incredible. And I
Not I, that they're I, yeah. always perfect.
No, I mean,
do you? I'm gonna tell the Satanic Temple story.
Oh, okay. Yeah, do it. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we didn't have any stars for The Witch. A24 felt they needed something special for marketing, and they wanted to have the Satanic Temple endorse the film. I don't have anything against the Satanic Temple or their political agenda or anything like that at all, but I didn't want the movie endorsed by the Satanic Temple. Like, I wouldn't want it being endorsed by something that called itself, like, you know, Christ's Temple either. And I have very tons of personal, philosophical, like semi-spiritual reasons for not wanting this. And also I said, you know, people are going to think I'm a fucking Satanist, but they did it anyway. And I hope it helped. but when I went to scout a film that was not made in Poland, the woman who was like running the film office said, "We don't want Robert Eggers coming to Poland because he's a Satanist."
Oh.
And did you not know this part of it?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
no.
And so we had to spend like a week like convincing them that I wasn't a Satanist before I could go scout in Poland.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think it's only fair that you should be able to speak out about it now here on their podcast.
Yes, exactly.
And so we'll see if they keep this in the podcast.
Yes, we'll see.
That's
But they're very, you know, they're great and they're collaborative. And
no, they're great. And look, like when I left AFI in 2010, there was nothing like this. Like I didn't know how I was going to make the films I wanted to make because I didn't see the platform for it. I wanted to make films that were not like achievable for like, you know, like $1 million, like, you know, people sitting in rooms talking, like, budget. And the fact that I was able to make Hereditary as my first feature, like, still I find staggering, and I'm so grateful for it. I recognize, like, how fortunate I was to be able to do it in that way. And the reason I, you know, it took me 10 years to make a film, and the reason, or I guess 8 years after AFI, and, you know, the reason for that is because I was very stubborn. I did not want to do it.
Very important.
Yeah, it's very important, and I'm glad I did. You know, I'm glad I did wait. But yeah, man, it's I will say that you know, A24 going like wide with a film like The Witch, or going wide with a film like Midsommar, it tickles me that it's happening, because there are people who are going to walk into Midsommar that like maybe. would certainly Nick never watch it, and I'm sure they'll regret watching it. But
there are going to be, you know, but on the other hand, there's going to be some high school students who that's going to be the first not like weird movie they've seen, and that's going to be amazing for them.
Yeah.
You know, because that like I had to cut off email contact because of like creepy occult people, unfortunately. But in the beginning, I made myself available, and it was amazing to get emails like from like high school students who saw The Witch and didn't know you could do something like that with movies, and that was super like super gratifying.
That's the other side of like the, you know, like the D cinema score.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's the other side
where
of it.
People walk out and they're like, "That wasn't scary. That was, you know, like that was boring and bullshit." You know,
yeah.
But you're gonna
and God bless him.
Yeah, God bless him. You know, maybe it'll like stick with them for like, you know, another day or two, and at least like kind of like bother them.
Yeah, bother them. And so finally, just because I don't know. Sorry, listeners, this is clearly my drum that I'm beating. Like, what if we can make it succinct? Like, what about Bergman is so darn great?
I mean, I don't know like a better like writer. Certainly of like monologues and dialogue.
For
and
sure.
Somebody who is able to just create the most like vivid interpersonal like dynamics in film. I can't think of anybody whose work is more devastating. Mm-hmm. Just as far as like character studies are concerned. And, you know, there's like an economy to his like visual language. I mean, you know, you could put a lot of that on his collaboration with Sven Nykvist, but even like when he was making films with Gunnar Fischer, like it's there.
For sure.
You know, like, and so I mean, if anything.
I mean, it's like, it's there in The Seventh Seal.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
It is. You know, it's sawdust and tinsel. I mean.
It's there from the beginning.
Yeah.
It's, absolutely. And I would say, you know, for me, that's a useful tether to like hold on to as a filmmaker, is like, you know, these films are so artful, so beautiful, like so impressive. on a technical level, and they so rarely like go beyond what's necessary. He's able to be like perfectly indulgent and also to like just eschew the extraneous, like,
and something that I find, sorry to cut you off, but something that I find so inspiring, though I'm certainly not capable of it yet, is that the indulgent shots like aren't experienced as indulgent often.
Yeah,
the opening of The Silence,
yeah,
is one of
the train.
It's so incredible how it shifts perspectives, and it's quite complicated, but you're unaware of it. And I feel like when I like watch John Ford or Hitchcock, like John Ford, I'm like, yeah, that's where you should put a camera. Good. That's where you should put a camera.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like Hitchcock, it's like, that's where you should put a camera, but that's a little surprise. Yeah. But Bergman, it's always wow, he put the camera there, but that is the perfect place. I would never think that that's exactly where you're supposed to put it, but that's the place. And again, it's unassuming. It's not, you're not like assaulted by the panache of the filmmaker.
And it feels instinctive.
Instinctive, yeah.
It feels totally instinctive. And I think there's something to be said also about, you know, I mean, people love to like deify these filmmakers and, you know, say like they came up with this and like nobody had done anything like this before. But I think there's something to be said about filmmakers being in dialogue with other filmmakers. Just as you mentioned that, you know, Bergman and Nykvist, you know, watched Tarkovsky's, you know, early films and like were just blown away, and it changed their way of making films.
And Andrei Rublev gets all the credit for kitchen sink, like medieval worlds, but like obviously The Seven Samurai did that you know, way earlier.
Absolutely. And even with The Silence, you can see like, oh, when did The Silence come out? Oh, it came out a year after Last Year at Marienbad, you know?
Yeah,
and,
for sure.
Yeah. It's a film set in this hotel that looks nothing like anything Bergman had done before,
right?
And looks everything like what he did
sure
afterwards.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I know that for me, my film school was just watching films I loved and then like kind of digging in and to see what are the films that those filmmakers were watching.
Same, yeah.
What are the films that impacted those filmmakers? And it's a rabbit hole that just like never ends. And,
how much do you rewatch movies?
A lot. I rewatch movies a lot to, you know, kind of like to the detriment of, you know, to the exclusion of like, you know, watching films for the first time, right?
And yeah, so, no, I mean, like, I've ruined some films that I've studied and taken so many notes that I can't, like,
the joy is gone.
The joy is gone.
But then, you know, you kind of, I think there's like, there was certainly a period where I was just like copying, and then you get to a point where you've done like enough trial and error that like there's something in your system and you kind of have like a foundation, and then you can kind of go off from there.
But yeah, you're watching so much stuff, and you're like, well, okay, like everything's an idea.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. You're like, well, that was an idea, and that was an idea, but like, I, you know, that's not my script. That's their script, and so we're just gonna try to do it. Like all that. Like I think, Beck, remember Beck?
Yeah,
had a quote that was something to the effect of, like, no matter how much I try to like shape one of my albums, like all that I'm with as far as like influences, I'm only left with what's inside of myself.
Yeah.
You know, and I think as you continue to become yourself more as someone who creates work, like that sense of self emerges more. And so even at, if you're studying something for staging or lighting or whatever, like it becomes less of I need to do that, and less of more like, oh yeah, like that's how I'm thinking about like my own ideas.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. I'm being told that it's time to wrap it up.
Great.
I could keep this going for a long time.
Same here.
It feels like we're just getting warmed up.
Well, you should come over soon, hang out with the baby.
I'd love to. I wanna see Houston again.
Okay.
This was great. There's nobody I would have, you know, rather done this with.
Same here.
And I'm so excited for people to see The Lighthouse, which I think is a great film with a capital G.
Thanks, man. You know, and see Midsommar. See it a second and a third and a fourth time and take notes. Destroy it.
Yeah, take it down. All right. Great.
Destroy it for the better, for, you know, for your film students, for to better your own filmmaking, not like,
right.
Not saying like take down Ari's movie, it's fucking great.
But, you know, hey, like, you know, it's a free country.
Thanks for listening. The A24 podcast is produced by us, A24. Special thanks to our editor, Tom Wyatt, and Robot Repair, who composed our theme.